eyes are blue. Shoots up through the stony ground. There's no room, no space to rent in this town. You're out of luck, and the reason that you had to care, the traffic is stuck, and you're not moving anywhere. You thought you found a friend to take you out of this place, someone you can lend a hand in return for grace. It's a beautiful.
Good afternoon, and it is a beautiful day to be a Unitarian Universalist. Oh. Let me hear you say amen.
Amen.
Woo. 2 days in a row. At least that's the way I feel, 2 days in a row. That's great stuff. So I am so pleased to have you here, and I think it is a beautiful day to be a Unitarian Universalist because it seems like one of the themes we keep hearing throughout this GA, somebody reminded me, today's hump day. One of the themes we keep hearing is that we are about ready to embark on a new Unitarian Universalism. We feel a big transition beginning to take place as the stars seem to come into line, and you're going to hear about some of those transitions today. I want to welcome those of you who are in our virtual community. Those who are online, I'm pleased to know that we are one of 9 workshops that's being live streamed. So we'll keep that in mind for better or for worse when we come to an opportunity for you to respond or ask questions or enter into conversation. The presentations you're going to hear this afternoon are from Unitarian Universalist ministers, for some of us colleagues. Many of them are recognizable names, not quite household names, but maybe we could say household if household is the Unitarian Universalist house, who have contributed to a book of essays that's going to be published in the mid-fall, late fall, and I hope you picked up a bookmarker that's got the title of that book, Turning Point, Essays on a New Unitarian Universalism. There are others who have contributed to the book, all total. I think there's over 15 different authors, essayists, but they couldn't all be here with us today. There are three sections to this book, and those same three sections are going to structure our conversation this afternoon. One of those sections is Stories of the Past. For some of you who know me, 2 years ago I gave the Berry Street Lecture and I talked about the trinity of errors that I believe have served Unitarian Universalists, or at least some Unitarian Universalists well, for 300 years. But those errors have now led us astray, and I believe, as do many others, if we continue to hold those up as to being who we are, we're not going to get out of the 21st century. So we also today are going to be talking about the trinity of promises, promises that can lead us into a bright future. And then the final section that we're going to be having today is about Unitarian Universalist futures. We're going to look at some different ministries and congregations and programs that are living those promises. And one of the things I want you to know is that in selecting, I'm a congregational minister, been a parish minister for over 40 years, and the ministries, the programs we're going to be looking at, I feel are adaptable by any congregation. These are certainly unique programs, but every congregation could take a version of this and take it home and do it. You just need a support group, you need maybe a little bit of money, not a lot, and there is money out there. And I'm happy to talk to some, not that I've got it, but I'm happy to talk to some of you about where we have gone, and maybe some of the folks can talk to you about that too. So these are opportunities for all of us to be able to do kind of a 21st century Unitarian Universalist ministry that is based on promises and not what I characterize as errors. I should introduce myself. I'm Fred Muir. I am the parish minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Annapolis, where I have been settled for the last 31 years, three glorious decades of ministry with that congregation. And I will be introducing, and each of our presenters today can say a little bit more about themselves when we get going. There will be a time for our virtual community, as well as those here, to ask questions, to respond, and I ask you to keep both of those short so we can keep going and enter into conversation. So let's get started. Let me offer a little bit of background as to how I believe we have gotten to this point, not only as Unitarian Universalism, but this point today in these presentations. In total, this collection of presentations and the essays that shape them is really about the future of Unitarian Universalism, a future to be constructed with the promises shaped by a theology and a history of promises of generosity, pluralism, and imagination. These promises, as promises often are a future waiting to be lived and loved. To arrive at this future, we must collectively, as Marlon Lavenhar so beautifully put it last night, we must liberate ourselves from a past that, while bright and bold for some, is no longer serving Unitarian Universalist dream of a 21st century faith. In fact, this past is replete with errors that I feel have been shaped by individualism, exceptionalism, and a posture of anti-authority. Errors that are now obstacles. They've become barriers preventing us from embracing our future. Is there a single source to both the promises and errors? Yes. For both, I suggest it's Ralph Waldo Emerson. His words were bold, fierce, and shaping for his generation and for ours. I really came into Unitarian Universalism through an Emersonian portal. I felt like he was channeling me in 1970. Like a lot of biblical scripture, his words have influenced many. Indeed, they have shaped our nation. And also, like sacred scripture, what we have done to and with the words of St. Emerson is perhaps some of the unintended results that can occur anytime we begin to scripturalize powerful ideas and words. Several generations have taken his ideas and meaning, interpreted and applied them to their now. This is what we do with words that move and inspire us. And there are consequences to this kind of application. Because Emerson was a patriot and a Unitarian Universalist, because his lectures and books were wildly popular and widespread, because he was claimed by a nation and a religious tradition that embraced the rise of the secular religion we call democracy, there is this blurring of the lines between Emerson and the American, and Emerson the American, and Emerson the Unitarian Universalist. And for good reasons, because the distinctions are not always clear. More to the point, the philosophy and theology and spirituality of Emersonian individualism, that is the uniqueness and joy of individual differences called individuality, became an ideology, a creed, and a dogma in both the United States and in Unitarian Universalism, and is now corrupting both with a short-sighted and shallow vision. As our nation expanded and as Unitarian Universalism grew, the ideology of individualism, and not the philosophy and theology of individuality, or sometimes we call it diversity, the celebration of diversity, became an accepted and embedded way of believing and living. It became an American way of life and a UU way of believing. It went from the value and celebration of differences to the dogma and demands of individual rights. And consequently, the corruption of Emersonian individualism has left us with a twisted definition of what it means to be an American and what it means to be a Unitarian Universalist. This corruption has permeated and shaped our way of economics, learning, leisure, and religion, which is to say that the perversion of Emersonian individualism is nearly complete and has damaged the promise of our relationship to each other in significant and in unfortunately lasting ways. This is far deeper than a simple lack of communitarian spirit or overemphasis on individual rights. This is not just a matter of figuring out a way to balance individual and community needs. Individualism as an ideology, theology, and dogma has been centuries in the making and found expression in Emerson and Transcendentalism and in the United States. The place and time was perfect, and it soared and soared for centuries. Historians and theologians have chronicled the physical and spiritual geography of individualism. For our new nation and its North Atlantic Anglo peoples, it was an ideology and theology that really worked. Some of those who were Unitarian Universalists, or at least we claim them to be UUs, eloquently contributed to and supported Emerson's vision. And yet there is, I think we all know, a shadow side to this individualism, a twisted and corrupted practice and articulation of what Emerson said. This twisted understanding of individualism found expression in a posture of anti-authority and exceptionalism. It is these expressions that have slowed any hope of progress and become a danger for both the United States and our beloved Unitarian Universalism, as each, many believe, teeters on free fall. Our presentations this afternoon will give further depth to the errors that we have experienced in Unitarian Universalism and speak to the emerging promises of generosity, pluralism, and imagination as a redeemed and restoried celebration of individuality and diversity. The words and examples in these presentations, I hope, will prod and provoke you. They may affirm and support you. I hope they will refresh, inspire, and deepen you. And I know that each presentation was composed in a spirit of goodwill and hope, each from a person who cares very much about our nation and about Unitarian Universalism. You may have chosen different words and expressions. You may have strong reactions or even confusion. But like you, each of the presenters embraces and loves our liberal tradition of faith. These presentations are in this spirit, a spirit that I believe will save Unitarian Universalism for new generations. Our first presenter is Tom Shade.
Well, as I look at my what I have written here, I realize that my first paragraph is completely bogus. And I'm to turn to Fred and say, Fred, thank you for this wonderful book. Of course, the book isn't out yet. And so I'll say that without having read it, thank you for this wonderful book. And then I will say, listening to the summaries of the authors here, I can tell it is an excellent book. But that was before I knew you were going to have me go first. So I haven't listened to the excellent summaries either. That said, you can believe the rest of us as you will. My little contribution, I'm going to read this. It's maybe a little dense, but he gives me 5 minutes, and I want to make sure that I stick within that. My little contribution to the book was to try to set the process of the evolution of Unitarian Universalism that Fred has described from I Church to Beloved Community into two different contexts, a different context than the philosophical context that Fred just explained that goes back to Emerson. One of my texts is James Fowler's Stages of Personal Faith Development, as outlined in the book Stages of Faith, published in 1981. Anybody who's been to seminary is familiar with this book. Many other people are. How many people know what I'm talking about here? Okay. So the rest of you try, you know, I can't explain it all in this length of time, but I hope that by glancing off of it, we'll be able to stay on the same page. By the book, you know. Right, Fred's book and even Fowler's book. The other context I want to place this in is the contemporary history of Unitarian Universalism from the middle of the 20th century on, our lifetimes, or at least my lifetime. I agree with Fred in saying that contemporary UUism has been stuck in a particular stage of faith development, what Fowler calls the fourth stage, which is the stage of individualizing faith. It is that stage of faith when one says, you know, this is who I am, and this is what I believe, and I can believe no other. And in our Unitarian Universalist new member classes, that story comes out all the time. The most common version is people saying, you know, I just couldn't say that Nicene Creed anymore, and I had to leave, and I came here. In World War II, after World War II, This gesture of individualizing faith, people grabbing their own faith, took the form of many people rejecting the dogmas of the Christian church, which had been hegemonic in our culture. And a whole bunch of these people became Unitarians and then Unitarian Universalists. And they carried with them certain attitudes about religious life that Reverend Muir sums up as I Church. That's the attitudes of individualism, of that this is for me, this religious life, that what counts most is what I believe, that we're all on our own separate journey. These attitudes turned out to be too weak to sustain Unitarian Universalism through the period of the conservative ascendancy in American culture, the Nixon, Reagan, Bush years. Especially for the boomer generation that had enrolled our children in religious education programs. Our children reported to us that they did not feel safe on the playgrounds of their schools because they could not defend or describe or explain who we were and what our religion was about. So Unitarian Universalism undertook a process at that stage of reworking earlier stages of faith, that earlier stage that comes before the individualizing stage, which is when a person goes, their faith development is based on group identity, where it's saying, this is who we are. This is what we believe. This is who I am. And it's a stage that, you know, is often associated with the earlier adolescence. And for most of our people, as come-outers, they did not undergo that stage inside Unitarian Universalism, but somewhere else. And so led by our religious educators, we started to build that process in to our faith development. And we started to work on Unitarian Universalist identity, which to the earlier folks, the people who were in that individualizing stage, you know, that stage, people used to say, we shouldn't even teach our kids to be Unitarian Universalists because we want them to have the same freedom of choice that we exercised. And then after this, in this later period, we're looking at, we want to teach our kids to be UUs. We want to give them UU values. We want to give them children's versions of the seven principles. And in that stage, which all of us were going through, building our Unitarian Universalist identity, we became very emotionally attached to the symbols that were us. The chalice, the flower communion, all of those things. You know, we have probably the highest proportion of tchotchkes and knickknacks to religion, to members of any faith tradition in the world. So part of our development has been to go back to what Fowler calls stage three faith. But at the same time, that individualizing stage of faith moves on inevitably to a higher stage, a different stage. If you go around saying, you know, this is what I believe, and I can believe nothing else and no other, the first thing you're going to do is run into somebody who says exactly the same thing, but believes exactly the opposite. And your choice is that you can either argue with them for the rest of your life or fight to make sure that their thoughts never get expressed in the worship service. Or eventually you have to come to the conclusion that the light shines through many windows, that there's many paths up the same mountain. And that stage we all went through together. It's what got us past the humanist-theist debate, that we were able to move to what Fowler calls a conjunctive stage, in which our identity is based on the fact that we are religiously diverse and that we have a strong identity as Unitarian Universalists. So we all have our tchotchkes, our t-shirts, our coffee cups, but we all accept the fact that we're all actually theologically different, but somehow still united in this one faith identity. Fowler calls this conjunctive faith, and it follows that individualizing moment, and it is present today among all of us. Now, my argument with Reverend Fred is that in our desire to move beyond individualism, we should not forget that for most of the world's people, they live in cultural circumstances where they are more limited by the push to conform than by the isolation of individualism. They're more limited by cultural pressures to conform than by the isolation of individualism. Most of the world's people are pushed into conforming to rigid gender roles, into racial stereotypes, into class limitations, into oppressive notions of sexuality. They do not feel free to say, this is who I am, and this is what I am, and this is my identity and my beliefs, and I can be no other. Unitarian Universalism will lose a vital piece of its soul, the reason for it being, If it loses touch with that moment in a person's life when self-expression, self-assertion, and self-determination are at work in their lives. So we must remember that our congregations are not the beloved community. They are but signals of what we imagine it to be, and that all of humanity is the beloved community. And it will take much rebellion on a personal level of people claiming their individuality and self-expression to get us to that beloved community. Thank you.
We are going to shift from a critique of where we have been to a projection of the promises of where we can go. And we're going to hear from Carlton Elliott Smith and Teresa Cooley and Rebecca Ann Montgomery. In that order. Carlton, thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. So I think I would start off by saying it's just so humbling to be part of this discussion and to see the faces of so many people who've contributed to my formation as a minister over the course of the past 21 years. So thank you all for that. My name is Carlton Elliott Smith. I'm a member of the Congregational Life Staff for the Southern Region of our association. I have seven colleagues, and we work the area from Texas and Oklahoma on the west over to Florida and the southern part of Virginia on the east, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and Mexico. There's only one congregation in Mexico, though, of ours, so there you have it. And in thinking about Unitarian Universalism, I think the my original title of the essay that I contributed to the book was Living in a Post-Unitarian Universalist World, is what it was titled. I don't think that actually worked for a Skinner House book, right? That would be kind of like antithetical. So we think we switched it up a little bit. But I'll tell you a bit about like how I got there. But I want to start off by saying a word about our theme within our themes within the Congregational Life Staff. Scott Taylor is the director for Congregational Life in our larger association, and Karen Anderson is his wife and co-conspirator in ministry. And one of the things that we've been talking about over the course of the past year are what we call the three I's, which are interconnection, innovation, and impact. And we allow those to be guiding principles for the work that we do. And so for my essay in the book, I focused on those three factors, trying to see what would it look like if we're looking at the future of Unitarian Universalism in the context of interconnection, innovation, and impact. And so I wanted to offer some examples of how I've seen that play out in my own ministry with an eye for the future. With regards to interconnection, some of you might have been in the celebration service that we had a few minutes ago. And, And I was talking a bit about our vote back in 2012 in 2010 when we voted to go to Phoenix rather than to boycott Phoenix, and how that was the opportunity for me to learn a lot more about immigration and its connection to civil rights work. It became an opportunity to build connections with people in immigrant communities there in Arlington, Virginia, where I was working. We had our crew from Arlington who's here. Arlington, yeah, in the house. The challenge for me was is I didn't know any dreamers. This is the time the Dream Act was very, you know, big in our consciousness. But it started with my just reaching out to someone in who is a friend of the congregation, a regular attender, who was on the Arlington County Board, Walter Tejada. I said, Walter, I got this idea. I want to do this service about dreamers. I don't know any dreamers. He hooked me up with a colleague of his who's on the school board, Emma Violan Sanchez, who had just started this organization called the Dream Project. And lo and behold, very soon after, I was able to put together a service on Martin Luther King Sunday that involved three dreamers, and that relationship has continued to cultivate and develop over the course of time, such that the congregation, even though I'm not there anymore, continues to be in relationship with the Dreamers. And so I say that to say that it can start with something small and grow outward from there. And when I left, one of the Dreamers in the service that was celebrating our time together, one of the Dreamers said to me, it's like when she told people where she was going that evening, she said, "I'm going to my church." Now, she hasn't joined the church, mind you, but she started thinking about it. It's like the church that she's at where they have their gathering meetings and that kind of thing. So she counts that as her church. So that's to say that I hope there'll be more interconnection or the realization that it's not all about what's going on in our congregations, what's going on further outside as well. So that's interconnection. Innovation. I think about the wonderful work of A. Powell Davies at All Souls in D.C. back in the 40s and 50s, and how he used the equivalent of our internet in his time to advance Unitarian Universalism in the national capital area through the use of what? Telephone wires and intercoms, so that he could broadcast his message from All Souls out into Arlington, which was the first of the, I want to say sibling, daughter congregations, if we're going to use gendered language, daughter congregations. And because he chose to use technology, there were eventually five daughter congregations and three granddaughter congregations in the national capital area, some of our strongest and most vibrant congregations now. So that's innovation. And we can do that today with the internet, with using those formats. Okay, so I've got, can I have one more minute? Okay, I'm going as fast as I can. Okay, and impact. Ultimately, I'm wondering if we want to see Unitarian Universalism go forward for its sake, but from my perspective, if we're able to keep our Unitarian ideals and principles going forward, I'm actually okay if 200 years from now there's not a Unitarian Universalist Association, if we can have the level of impact such that people have the experience of love and connection everywhere they go, even if they don't remember that we had something to do with it. Okay, I'm done. Thank you.
So I'm Teresa Cooley. I'm the Program and Strategy Officer for the UUA. And in that position, I oversee all of our program offices. And one of the delights of this position when I first started a couple of years ago was that we began to bring in groups that had not previously been a part of our program structure, most notably the International Office. And it was really interesting to put the International Office in the same room with our ministry and faith development teams and our congregational life teams and our multicultural growth and witness teams. And all of a sudden, it became dramatically apparent to me that we have been a totally isolationist movement. That we only understand ourselves as American. Not even North American anymore, American. And what does that say about us? And I know where some of that comes from. I know that some of it comes from a sense of intercultural incompetence. That we're kind of uncomfortable with reaching out to different cultures that feel very different from us because we don't necessarily trust that we will be able to do it A, without arrogance, or B, without ignorance, right? So that's one of the issues. The other issue is that it's a resource issue. You know, for a long time, the only way we understood ourselves as being able to, something just flew from the sky. Wow, that's really interesting. Woo. We've understood the only way to start new movements is to send somebody physically out to build a congregation, a grouping of people that would ultimately hire a minister, build a building, etc. And we didn't have the resources to do that as an American movement for the whole world, right? We didn't have enough evangelists that we could send out in that sense. And so it didn't feel fair to do these things with unsupported staff. Well, all of a sudden, all of those things have changed, right? We're beginning to learn some intercultural competence. We're beginning to recognize the way in which we are one world, how we cannot understand ourselves in isolation from the rest of the world. And we're beginning to find ways to connect that don't require us to physically cross the globe. Many technologies that allow us to create truly intimate communities, even if they're virtual. And so the challenge for me is, how do we understand ourselves and move out into that world in a way that learns from where we've been, that does not take on the arrogance of typical American imperialism when we've gone out into the world, that begins to help teach us the cultural intercultural competence that we need in order to move out. And a place where we can learn these things is right in our backyards, right? We can learn these things first and foremost through groups that are beyond our congregational walls. People that are organizing themselves, and we'll hear some stories of those, who are organizing themselves and finding ways to create community that don't require all of the infrastructure that our current congregations require. So that's one way in which we can learn these things and help build and bud some different gatherings across the world. Another way of learning these things is to plumb our experience, particularly right now with the Black Lives Movement. Because in the Black Lives Movement, we have to understand ourselves with complete humility, right? Complete humility, and be able to stand in solidarity, to be able to let others lead, to be able to recognize the particular place and cultural context out of which we individually or collectively are formed. That is the kind of attitude with which we can go to the rest of the world with a sense of openness and with a sense of invitation and with a sense of fellowship. Thank you.
Everyone. So I probably am the only person that's going to put a water bottle on the podium that says United States Army, Army Strong. So I am the cultural interloper. I am Rebecca Montgomery. I'm a Unitarian Universalist minister, but I'm also a U.S. Army chaplain. I was ordained in 2002 and commissioned into the Army shortly thereafter. So I've never served a parish. So being raised as a Unitarian Universalist and doing worship on Sundays, supporting the congregations in the DC area, I'm sort of that cultural interloper, and I love the smiles. I see so many people that I recognize in this room. I thank you from the bottom of my heart for being here. So I would like to bring you the military chaplaincy model to our congregational approach. And what I mean by that is people come through our doors because they know our message. They're familiar with what we believe in, but they stay for the relationships. They stay for our heart. They stay for the ways in which we welcome, love, accept, and worship and celebrate and mourn with them. And that's what I do as a military chaplain. It's really strange. I was raised UU, but I bring Unitarian Universalism into the Army. Just don't tell them. Because I don't have to, because I approach my chaplaincy as a Unitarian Universalist. I radiate that welcome, open heart. And so my three lessons learned, if you saw or if you heard me speak before, I say this often, starts with radical hospitality. How we welcome people into our space, that non-judgmental presence, that welcoming them in, whoever you are, come whoever you are welcome here. That radical hospitality of, what can I do to make you feel welcome? And we're having some challenges here in this space. Space matters. Language matters. How we interact with each other matters. The words that we use matter. So being very sensitive to that and not being too rigid, but expansive in our language and our approach to hospitality. That's my first. As an Army chaplain, I can tell you that's what I do first. And second is suspending judgment. One of my favorite quotes is by Joel Osteen. It says, our job is not to judge. Our job is to lift the fallen and heal the broken. So we're not here to judge anyone's walk or path, their struggles, their joys, their triumphs, their sorrows. Our job is to walk with them. So to be non-judgmental. And in that, and I was raised UU, and I say this with a lot of heart, we don't do well one thing. And that's being uncomfortable. Being uncomfortable with people who are different than us. Just preached on this last Sunday. I believe the realization of the beloved community, begins with when we are comfortable with being uncomfortable with people who are not like us. So across the planet, this is how I'm sowing peace as a military chaplain. One heart at a time, across the planet, radiating that heart of, I see you. I see you as you are. You don't look like me. You don't sound like me. You don't love like me. You don't think like me. Some of my best friends are evangelical chaplains. But we unite around the mission. We unite around serving soldiers and families who are hurting and broken. It doesn't matter that he can't even possibly understand what I believe and how I worship, and I can't relate to his faith, but we unite in friendship and we unite around the mission. So being comfortable with being uncomfortable is a way of offering non-judgmental presence, a radical hospitality, and as a military chaplain, in building our communities through relationships. How did I do on time? Outstanding. Okay, let's see, what else do I have? Ultimately, the question that I feel that we're answering with this approach is, will you accept me? That is what people are seeking as they're walking through our doors, is will you accept me as I am, as I'm striving to be? And it's not me standing up on Sunday morning as the visiting minister or as the guest minister preaching my heart out and saying what my little strange brain has come up with and my spirit bubbles forth. It's the congregation that does the hard work. You are the face of our faith. You are the ones that radiate our hearts. You are the ones that keep people in our communities. And when they feel broken, to welcome them back. One of my sermons, I hope I'm staying on point to what I wrote, because this is not quite what I wrote. One of the things, one tiny rabbit trail and then I'm done. One of the things that I preach on often is when you feel disjointed or disenfranchised in our communities, is come back to the table. Walk out the door for as long as you need to, but please come back to the table. One, so we can start the process of forgiveness. Two, so we can start the process of understanding. But also three, so we're not denied your light, whatever your light may be. We are only strong as the many stars in the sky. We're only as diverse as those who are willing to be in relationship with us. So these are my humble thoughts as a military chaplain for our congregation, for our wider movement, and I thank you for your hearts and the ways in which you serve.
So I'm just going to keep moving, and hopefully when we get close to ending, there'll be an opportunity for some questions. And so this first section, and the first section in the book, is really kind of a critique of where we've been, some of the things that have gotten in our way. The second section is the promises of Unitarian Universalism, the sense of urgency that many feel that something needs to move ahead. And then the last section is about new ministries, new programs, a ministry of those promises into the 21st century. So we're going to begin with a video, we're going to end with a video, and then we're going to hear from three others. And one of the things I feel is important to realize, especially in starting with new ministries, some of them work, some of them don't work, some of them have profound lessons for us, some of us, there's always lessons. And again, I want to raise up that I particularly chose the presenters you're going to hear and the ones that aren't here, because these are all things that in our congregational life I feel are possible for any congregation. So we're going to start with a video from Ian Marr, who is here, and will be willing to talk with you when we get to that point.
At Original Blessing, our mission is to transform the lives of the 400,000 people who live in North Brooklyn and Western Queens.
I think that there is a need or a want for a spiritually progressive voice.
Our sermons aren't based on what's happening in a book. It's based on what's happening in the news. That's where we live. We're not living in a book. We're literally living here.
We don't have like a this I believe and therefore you should believe this.
I find that there's a give and take in discussion of what God or the Creator is.
Everybody finds that they feel like they belong.
You don't have to be anything. You just have to show up.
It's not like the people who are there are the only people allowed.
It's a wonderful place to interact with people without anything other than, hi, I see you. How are you today?
It's singing, it's dancing, and it's joy.
People say things like, well, God loves, and then you better change your life or you're going to go to hell. There is no experience with God that would ever condemn you to hell.
We're born with worth and dignity and goodness that doesn't need to be earned.
We're born from love, and that's all we want for the rest of our lives.
That's it.
You know, all I wanted for us to do as a community is just go out and just love the hell out of the world.
All of the things that the world is suffering from can't be eliminated until we start with understanding that we're all interconnected and that in order for me to get somewhere, I need to help everybody that comes into my path.
For me, original blessing is really spirituality through service.
I've never been a part of a community like that before. It's always been more like someone should do something about that. And today I see that I can be that someone.
How can I help make this a more uplifting, a more fulfilling place for other people to be?
When we move from, oh, I want to pray to have a calm life or meditate to have a calm life, to I want to meditate and pray for you to have a calm life.
It's not about me as an individual becoming better, but I need to help you, you need to help me, and that it's as we figure these things out that we all grow and become more of ourselves.
I think I have escaped from a sense of loneliness and disconnection.
I really have that desire for us to be more connected in the ways that we live with one another.
You know, being out there and telling people that there's a greater experience of love and we would love to walk that path with them.
So we're going to look at these other ministries now, and I'm just going to let people know what the order is, and I'll just let you come on up. Actually, I'm going to introduce them by their projects. So we're going to hear next about the Lucy Stone Cooperative and then the Sanctuary Boston. We're going to hear a little bit about theme-based church, and then we'll end with another video about the sanctuaries in D.C. All these sanctuaries. What's going on here? So the Lucy Stone Cooperative.
Hello, everybody. My name is Heather Concannon, and I am one of the founders and also a resident at the Lucy Stone Cooperative, which is a 12-person intentional living community in Boston based on the values and tradition of Unitarian Universalism. And the Lucy Stone Cooperative opened our doors. We purchased our house in 2010, so we've been open for 4.5 years now. But before that, there was about a year and a half of organizing and planning and scheming and building. Oh.
No, it's not me either. I want my money back. Can you help out at all?
Is the other
No, that one's not working, but maybe if you just stand right in the center up here.
Resolve
So this is one of these opportunities where only the people, the virtual community can hear us.
If you use this microphone.
Oh, really?
None of you who are actually here can hear us.
Sounds good. Hi, everyone. I'm Dave Ruffin. I'm the founder of the Sanctuary Boston, where I worked with a wonderful team in realizing that community. I have not served it for the last year. I've been a resident minister in All Souls, Tulsa. The Sanctuary Boston is a community, an alternative community of worship and connection that was grounded in Unitarian Universalism, like the Lucy Stone community co-op. But pulled together more than anything by a commitment to co-create an experience of sanctuary for seekers of all kinds. And we met in two different worshiping, hosting communities, First Church in Boston and First Parish in Cambridge. But to bring you into this, I'd like to share what the song that was at the heart of our community with you all, get you singing a little bit, if that's okay. I'll sing it for you once first. It goes like this. Make us aware we are a sanctuary, each made holy and loved right through with thanksgiving. We are a living sanctuary. Try this with me. Make us aware. I'll sing it first. I'm glad that you guys are catching on quickly. Make us aware we are a sanctuary. Try that. Make us aware we are a sanctuary, each made holy and loved right through. Each made holy and loved right through with thanksgiving. We are a living sanctuary anew. Let's sing that. With thanksgiving, we are a living sanctuary anew. Amen. So I want to ask you, by way of trying to connect with you all a little bit here, if you've ever had an experience that I've had a number of times in my life where, I'll try to speak up, just let me know, where you really need a hug. You really just need an embrace, that physical, palpable experience that you're loved and that you're connected, maybe with someone in particular that you're in relationship with, or maybe just with anyone, just someone to remind you of that. And you get a hug, but you don't actually get the embrace that you needed. Are you following me? What I mean to say is that, you know, you get embraced, but just when you think you're going to get that experience of release of your heart and your body, lowering its defenses and just giving in to these arms that are enveloping you and feeling the strength and the energy and the love flowing through your body anew so that your arms can be filled with that strength and grip them even tighter. Just when you feel you're about to experience that, for some reason, they pull away. For some reason, they stop just short of that. They release you before you can really release. And there are all kinds of reasons. From a sort of macro historical perspective, Fred and Tom have been pointing towards some of that already, that we stop short of giving each other that embrace in life. I feel very lucky that the first time I walked into one of our sanctuaries, I received the embrace that I very much needed at that time in my life, a time when I was fighting depression and felt as unsure of love's embrace and my connection as I really ever have. And my experience of worship and of the community that I walked into was absolutely of being rebound in that embrace. And that's the origin point of why I'm here today amongst you in Unitarian Universalism, and the origin point of where I felt my connection to a call to ministry. And in a sense, it's also the origin point of why, thank you, try to wrap up quick, the origin point of why I'm here on this panel talking about Sanctuary Boston, or at least about what's fueled me in Sanctuary Boston. Because what happened for me is that I came to find that experience of embrace in our communities was actually all too rare of an experience. For years traveling as an actor, first in my 20s, and then church shopping in Boston while I was actually in seminary, I just couldn't find a place that would truly meet me with arms that held me as long and held me as fully and freely as I needed to be held so that I could fully show up and release and give all that I wanted to give, both my joy and my sorrow too. And so Sanctuary, aside from being, I hope maybe you've heard through the grapevine, a really fresh and dynamic and innovative and alternative new young adult multi-generational led worshiping community that's still rocking in Boston, is I hope more than anything a testimony to what can happen when a group of people come together around the vision of committing to co-creating together, to showing up for such an embrace, for such an experience of that love that we believe in, so that we not only affirm that we're inherently worthy and that everyone else is, but that we feel that worthiness and we feel that love and we feel the power of the love within us, so that we really have arms with the strength that we need to embrace the world. That's a sanctuary movement that I think we can all get behind. Thanks. So you mean it's just not us?
I'm Karen Anderson. I'm the... Wow. That was because of this, right? Not just because you love me. Oh, okay, thank you. I'm Karen Anderson. I'm the senior minister at the First Unitarian Church in Rochester, New York. Rochester, New York, which is a congregation of about 1,000 members. And I'm also the lead minister at the Unitarian Congregation in Canandaigua, New York. That's why theme-based ministry, you will see quickly, matters. I do want to say, what's the insight about this? Why does it matter? And what's the practical application? Okay? So for me, one of the insights, there are two insights for us, but one was with theme-based ministry, this idea that ministers often ask, what do we want from parishioners, right? We want like time, talent, treasure. We want them to understand church is not a product or a service, but it's working into a co-op. But when we switched to theme-based ministry, it made me switch the question from what do we want from parishioners to what do we want for them. And I want them to live a life of connection. I want them to feel like they make a difference in the world. I want them to feel like their life matters. And when I did that, it like changed around my whole view of ministry in a lot of ways. One of the other pieces about the insight of theme-based ministry is, Unitarian Universalism is about connection. I'm so sorry. Doesn't seem like it makes sense. Okay. So Unitarian Universalism is about connection. I think, at its core, that the world out there disconnects you from all that gives you meaning. It's a very shallow, materialistic, frantic life. And what our job is in our congregations is to help people connect, to have spiritual connection to their deepest selves, to life's gifts, and serving needs greater than their own. And for us, this theme-based ministry kind of helps you focus on the spiritual value that our faith tradition has historically honored and emphasized. We're reminded that our faith dreams of a preferred way for us to be in the world, and that challenges each of us to ask, what does it mean to live a life with these particular values front and center? There's a important reminder about it. It's not true that Unitarian Universalism, anything goes. Rather, our faith has a unique vision of the good life. Yes, we affirm individual choice and individuality, but there are some core values that our faith asks us to engage and take seriously and apply in our daily lives. So for theme-based ministry, not only does it relate to that theology of spiritual connection, but it takes that frantic world when you do 1 week on one topic, 1 week on another topic, 1 week on another topic. You allow people to go broader and deeper very quickly, especially when you have it from worship to RE to social justice to book groups, to public witness, to everything you do. You put through the filter of what is it that worship theme is. What does it mean for us to be a people of? I also think that one of the reasons it matters is that if you look at the numbers of people who feel disconnected from somebody that they can give their life to, do you know what the number is now? It's one person. One person they can feel vulnerable with. One person that they can tell their fears and hopes and dreams and disappointments to. When you have theme-based ministry and you have small groups, I have about 300 people at First Unitarian in small groups around Soul Matters, which is shared with a number of different congregations. But people have 7 to 8 people that they are going deep with and they trust and respect. And they also, then when they get in the car with their kid, they have questions to ask because it's on the same theme that they just heard and worked on that whole time. So for us, that's a really great way to get people to feel like, I'm going to get to that question. I'm going to help them see what we want for them, that they know that their life makes a difference. The practical application of that means that it gets connected through all of those aspects of church. But then I just realized recently, maybe a practical application, I'm sorry, I'm going to talk really fast, that is perhaps most important is when I say I'm the lead minister at Canandaigua, which is a congregation of 80 people. We have a yoked congregation or a partnered congregation, so we share staff and resources. But we also have the ability, when you have more than one congregation that's connected on themes, you have ministers who are not isolated anymore. You have the ability to be able to have teams that can work with one congregation to another and another. And it gets to that place of, you know, what we're talking about of saying, really, in truth, the world needs us to put we above I. And the only way we're going to be able to do that is to take our interdependence more seriously than our independence. And we see that as one great way to be able to kind of affirm and live into that and be a gift to one another in congregations rather than our kind of like own autonomous selves and only caring about what's going on individually. So.
So because we lost the audio, we're not going to be able to hear about the Sanctuaries DC, which is a very exciting program. I would encourage you when you get home to Google, do a search on Sanctuaries DC, which is really about ministry located in the arts. And when you look, the videos are amazing. When you see who makes up this congregation, it is largely people under the age of 35, largely people of color, doing hip-hop, poetry readings, music, art. It's just fantastic. And Eric Martinez Restley is the lead in all of that. And I'm sure he would love to share what he's doing with you. It's really a very exciting program. So I hope you can begin to see this movement, which I have characterized as the errors that are no longer working for us, of individualism and exceptionalism and anti-authority, and how, you know, the spirit of promises, of generosity, imagination, and pluralism are the future, especially when you see it in these new ministries, which I hope, again, you can see that any congregation can do these. You know, these are not just, I mean, these are special people. They're colleagues, right? But they're creative people. But it's that restoring and reimagining our historical roots in a new, fresh way. And that's going to see us on. This is really an exciting time to be a Unitarian Universalist, but you got to be a little bit bold. Right. You got to let go of the past and try something that is new but is still Unitarian Universalist. So we actually have about 3 minutes. If if anybody has a particular question or a general question, but if you would please stand up and I'll try to repeat. Right.
Could I get a specific example of how moving beyond individualism would change within a congregation?
An example of how moving beyond individualism could change in a congregation. Does somebody want to do that, or do you want? Okay, we're glad. Oh man, we got them all.
I do lead a congregation. He goes, you actually lead a congregation. I do. For me, here's a great example. We are on Soul Matters themes. One of our small groups had, in a Soul Matters group, if you weren't in that small group, what happened in the small group, one of the women was due with a baby. She lost it 2 days before she was due. By the time the ministers found out, her small group had taken care of meals for 2 months, childcare for her other kid, and had her house cleaned for two months. Then the ministers found out. So what it does is it allows people to be able to minister to each other, which actually is shared ministry. That's what we're supposed to be doing, not us ministering to you. You all have a call. You're all the church. The church is not a building or a person or any of that. The church is wherever you are living the mission of, you know, kind of listen, open, and serve into the world. That's where the church is, wherever you are doing that. You guys are the church.
Simple question, simple answer to the question you asked. If the people coming out of your church are asking the question, did that service meet my needs? Or are they coming out of the service saying, was that service something that would be of service to people in our community? And if people shift that thinking, what we're doing on Sunday morning is not to make ourselves happy or to make ourselves feel good, but as a service to our community. Are we improving the life of our community by what we did in that last hour? You've shifted from individualism to beloved community.
Let's end on that note. Beautifully stated, Tom. Thank you very, very much, everybody. Have a great GA.
are your congregational leaders asking the question, are we meeting our needs, or are we meeting the new people who are coming in, the people who are the first time here, the people who are the 10 times here, the people who are 3 weeks away from coming the first time, right? You know, all those people on the first step. Yeah, I mean, you know, so you can't, you know, you can't, I mean, you can't really serve people who aren't here in a certain way. They would come for anything that you want. You know, you're really good at that. There are so many things you are not good at, right? And, you know, I think a church just has to be, and we were a church of 4 years, right? I think a church really has to go, what is it that we're good at, and get really good at that. And then look at what is it that we could be good at if we get the resources.
Well, there's one thing to get it, resistance,
and then to say, you know, things are not going to be good, you know? That's when you start to really start thinking about
multi-faith,
cooperation with other churches.
Great job.
Aren't we lucky to have colleagues who say yes?
Great job. So. I know.
Yeah.
same levels as before. Okay. It's weird.
Hello? Check. Hey, 1, 2. Yeah, yeah. Hey, check. 1, 2.
Marshall Hawkins works